In school, on the big screen, and in the media, Americans are lectured about the legacy of slavery and how it has held back the black community.
They're going to put you all back in chains.
This country was founded on white supremacy, and every single institution and structure that we have in our country still reflects the legacy of slavery.
America has a history of 200 years of slavery.
We live in a country now where the president is advancing environmental racism, economic racism, criminal justice racism, healthcare racism.
With this idea seeping into every aspect of our culture, what do black Americans need to do to finally overcome America's original sin? I'm Patrick Carelci.
And I'm Adriana Cortez.
And this is Red Pilled America, a storytelling show.
This is not another talk show covering the day's news. We are all about telling stories.
Stories Hollywood doesn't want you to hear.
Stories the media mocks. Stories about everyday Americans that the globalists ignore.
You could think of Red Pilled America as audio documentaries, and we promise only one thing. The truth.
Welcome to Red Pilled America.
Throughout the day, you can't turn on the TV, radio, or computer without hearing about racism in America and the lasting legacy of slavery. As hard as you may try to avoid the topic, it's become a constant motif in our daily lives. You're hearing about it right now. We were promised that the election of Barack Obama would finally put an end to the legacy of slavery.
There is not a black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America.
But race relations have arguably gotten worse since the election of the first black president. What does the black community need to do to finally overcome the legacy of slavery? To find the answer, we're going to follow the story of a family that faced years of racist attacks and what they did to overcome them. This may sound odd today, but a Mexican man dating a Caucasian woman was once relatively rare. When witnessed, it even raised the suspicion of law enforcement.
Rudy and I were stopped on numerous occasions just to be stopped. Nothing, no headlights out, no tail lights out.
That's Nancy. Her new love interest, Rudy, looked indigenous Mexican, very brown. Nancy is Irish. As an 18-year-old young lady, she was lily white with hazel eyes. In the late 1960s, interracial couples weren't yet a thing. The two met at a local dance club called Baby Huey's in Gardena, California, a suburb roughly 15 miles south of downtown Los Angeles. Once they met, Rudy and Nancy quickly began dating. In those early years when the cops saw them driving down the street on their nights out, they'd pull them over to make sure Nancy was okay. The interrogations occurred so often that it became a bit of a routine for Rudy.
You know, I would like to sit back and say how many times it happened, but God, I'm going to say at least a dozen times. He knew it and expected it. He knew what was happening. Let's put it that way. I'm not going to say he expected it, but when we got stopped, he knew right away what was going to happen. He had to get out, you know, and sometimes he didn't have to get out. So, and I think that them seeing me sitting in the car with the, you know, an obviously Mexican guy, just, you know, it was an alert thing to them. It was like driving while black, you know, it was just one of those things. So, yeah, we got stopped and they would check his ID and check for whatever it was they had to check for. In those days, they didn't, you know, you had to sit there for a while because you couldn't get online or do it yourself.
Nancy says it didn't seem to bother Rudy. He grew up in a slightly rougher neighborhood, served in Vietnam, and respected law enforcement. But the constant inquisition infuriated Nancy because it was something entirely new to her. She came from the predominantly white suburb of Torrance, which bordered Gardena and stretched all the way to the Pacific Ocean. At that young age of 18, Nancy was naive to the ways of the world. She spent her early years in Catholic school, then by fourth grade transitioned to public school. In her day, society self-segregated and largely kept to their own neighborhood.
But it was just the way that it was, and you had your own community, and you had everything to do in your own community. It was such a fear of having, you know, any kind of other culture than your own. You were, like, looked at, and you were, you'd have to categorize everybody, black, white, Mexican, everybody as a racist in those days. Everybody, because they all did the same thing.
And if some outsiders tried to make inroads into a neighborhood populated by people that weren't of their kind, the locals made moves to stop them. Nancy remembers one of those instances.
Of Manhattan Beach, they had, there was this big plot of land that's still there, and they were going to build brand new houses on that land. And they had some black families that were interested, wealthy black families that came in. Not wealthy, but could afford it. A bunch of Manhattan people got together, bought the property, donated it to the city to use as a park, and it's still there.
By the time she'd met Rudy, this kind of behavior already left a bad taste in her mouth. So when the cops repeatedly interrupted Nancy and Rudy from getting from point A to point B on date night, over time it began to leave a mark, even making her a bit protective over the issue. The racial profiling felt like an injustice that shouldn't exist. Whether you were black, white, Mexican, Asian, or whatever, if you weren't bothering anyone, in her estimation, no one should be bothering you. The two forged through the profiling, continuing to date even as it ruffled some feathers in their respective families and communities.
In those days, all I thought of was how great this was, and and how much in love I was falling in love, and first time ever for that kind of thing.
In 1969, Rudy and Nancy married. A few months later, they had their first son, me, your humble host. And 2 years after that, my sister Denise was born. We were a pretty happy crew. Dad was outgoing, always wanting to go on excursions. Nancy was shy and perhaps a bit of a homebody, so the dynamic worked out for both of them. The young couple hardly had two nickels to rub together. We first moved to Dad's hometown of Gardena, then bounced around to a series of apartments in my mom's hometown of Torrance. The two scrimped and saved for a couple of years. In those days, it wasn't unheard of to get into a mortgage with a few thousand dollars. By 1975, they'd saved enough to start looking to buy a house.
We had a real estate guy looking for us, and, you know, we were just looking for houses. And, we looked at a lot of places. After I thought about it, after years went by and I really thought about it and I knew more about George, which was Rudy's friend who was the real estate guy, he just wanted to sell us a house.
The realtor was using a technique of that time, and that was show the client dump after dump after dump.
And I mean places in Gardena that you couldn't have the dog live in it.
And then once they saw those, the realtor would take them to the house that they really wanted to sell them. The internet wasn't around at the time, so you couldn't pop onto Zillow or Trulia or any number of other real estate sites to get a layout of the land. So for most people in the midst of this grift, it was hard to get a handle on what was happening.
And we told him what we wanted. I wanted a community with kids. It just was really important to me that we lived in a community with kids where you could, like, play outside. So this guy started looking, and then we found this. We looked at all these different houses, and then we found the one in Carson. He brought us to Carson. New community, new homes.
Carson is a suburb of Los Angeles, just south of a little-known town at the time called Compton.
Lots of kids in that neighborhood. There were kids everywhere. And we were still young enough, and everybody else was still young enough to have children. So you knew it was an up-and-coming, lots of culture. You had Samoans, blacks, whites, Asians. It was perfect. The home was beautiful. It was only two bedrooms, but, you know, it had a family room and a living room and a big kitchen. And it was a beautiful neighborhood.
It was a new community. The city had only incorporated a few years earlier in 1968. The homes were also relatively new. The yards were well kept. It looked like a solidly middle-class neighborhood.
But to me, it was like like this utopia of, it, as a young family, you know, here I am in what, my mid-20s or so, and I'm just thinking this is like perfect. It's the kind of neighborhood I grew up in without the farmland. But, you know, lots of kids riding bikes in the, you know, in the street, playing ball and all of this kind of stuff. And we fell in love with the house.
So Mom and Dad brought a few people to come check it out.
And before we moved in, you know, my brother-in-law, Terry, he came over and he said, don't do it.
She also brought her dad and oldest brother to the house, and they warned them against buying the house as well. The neighborhood was about 50% black and a smattering of everything else. Everyone that advised them against moving in expressed that they were worried that they wouldn't fit in with the demographics of the area. But having grown a bit sensitive to the racial profiling just a few years earlier, Mom was a bit protective over the issue. So any attempt to dissuade them from living in an ethnically diverse neighborhood was quickly discarded.
And it was, a lot of it was because it was a minority neighborhood, but to me it just did, that should not have mattered. If we're going there, we're peaceful people, we're not going to bother them, and if we're nice neighbors and they're nice people and we're nice people, then what more could you ask for? We wanted something diverse. We wanted something young with kids in it, where the kids were going to have fun. And we were friendly, you know, people that didn't care what color you were. So how much more perfect can it be? Because if I don't care what color you are, you're not going to care what color I am, right?
So Mom and Dad purchased the house. It was a proud day. We took the classic family picture in front of our new casa. But what the young couple didn't realize at the time was that this area of Carson was going through a major shift. Welcome back. So by 1975, Nancy and Rudy saved up enough money to buy a home in Carson, California that they fell in love with. But what the young couple didn't realize at the time was that this area of Carson was going through a major shift. By the second week in our new home, troubling signs started to show.
I was at work. You guys were at school. Rudy was at work. And we came home with the police at the house.
Someone had broken in.
He got in the garage somehow. I don't think the garage door, access door, had no lock on it. And so he got in that way. But we had the doors. Everything was locked. And he tried to kick the door, and you could see the feet prints on the door coming in from the garage, the access door from the garage. And then he just went around in the back and just put something through the window and came in through the window. I can say I was more pissed off and angry at the mess that they left. I mean, it looked like they picked up the house and shook it. It was beyond ransacking. It was like, you know, and then took anything of value. And we didn't have a lot of value. You know, everything that we moved into that house with was given to us by somebody else. A family member, or it was secondhand, or something. We just had no money. The bed that we slept in was my mom and dad's bed.
The thief was brazen. He hit up a few houses on the block all at once. Someone heard him and called the cops, and they nabbed the scum as he was robbing the place across the street. For me, it was a coming-of-age moment. The criminal had a big black Glad trash bag and filled it with whatever he could. When the police brought the bag into our house, I locked in on something that is still burned into my brain today. The bag was tied shut with my red bandana. The thief used my favorite cowboy bandana to secure his ill-gotten gains. It was the first moment where I realized that there were people out there that wanted to take what I had. As troubling as the situation was, it could have been chalked up to just a fluke. A bad seed had made his way into the neighborhood. It was hopefully an anomaly. However, another red flag was about to go up. A few months after moving in, our parents threw a housewarming party. They invited friends, family, and the realtor that sold them the house.
And when he came to the housewarming, he was carrying a gun. And he brought it in our room, in the master bedroom, and he showed us the gun for protection, he said. And immediately I thought to myself, you've sold us a home in a neighborhood that you feel compelled to arm yourself when you come to visit us for a housewarming. But again, I'm still so young and naive, I wouldn't let it sink in.
By the time that we'd moved into the house in Carson, my mom had been using a babysitter near her work to watch my sister and I during the day. So to make sure that I had someone to come home to after school, Mom arranged for us to use the babysitter's address to attend an elementary school near her work. The area was made up of predominantly Hispanics, Blacks, and Asians, with a sprinkling of whites. It had the feeling of an elementary school version of Welcome Back, Carter, if you understand that reference. As we settled into our new home in Carson over the first few years, houses were going up for sale throughout the neighborhood. The Samoans, the Asians, and the whites were putting their houses on the market, and the properties would be scooped up exclusively by Black families. The process happened in just a few years in our enclave in Carson. By the time I'd become old enough to play outside by myself, roughly 7 years old in the 1970s, we were the only white family in the neighborhood. Everyone else was Black, and I mean everyone. But honestly, I didn't notice, and neither did my sister.
That park had a club, big clubhouse there. And they had a dance, modern dance thing, you know, where they put the makeup on and they had the leotards and all of this kind of stuff. And so they went to the fair and performed at the Pomona Fair here and the whole bit. And I remember one time somebody saying to Denise, I'm going to say she was probably six, seven, eight, something like that. And somebody saying, are you the only white kid in the performing? And she thought, I don't know. She didn't even think about it. And I thought, okay, this is good. This is good. And she was the only white kid.
My sister and I had two good friends, a brother and sister duo named Maurice and Heather Sims. Maurice and I would play pickup football games on the street with the neighborhood kids. All the guys would take out our BMX bikes to a local vacant lot that had huge hills to drop in and mounds of dirt we'd use as jumping ramps. On the weekends, Maurice and I would run the streets with the neighborhood boys. Denise was too young to be outside without supervision, but she'd play with Heather either at our place or at the Sims' house right down the street. For a few years, everything was relatively normal. We got some looks around town for sure, but we were largely left alone. My baby brother Casey was born when I was about 9 and a half, and around that time, the atmosphere oddly began to shift. An animosity towards our family began to brew. It seemed like overnight, my name went from Patrick to Honky, and my friends pretty quickly dwindled down to just Maurice. A few years ago, I was having dinner with a prominent Hollywood TV writer, and somehow the topic of the racial slur Honky came up. He laughed at how unscary it sounded. Well, the word takes on a whole new meaning when you're surrounded by 5 or 6 Black guys yelling it at you, I responded. The idea was so foreign to him, he didn't know how to respond. That's what I was going through as 1980 arrived. Being the only sibling that was allowed to play outside by myself, I got that slur frequently thrown at me. Denise, who'd just reached the proper age to start playing outside without constant supervision, began to feel the heat as well while skipping rope with the neighborhood girls.
We would do the double dutch, right?
That's Denise.
And I was terrible at it. And they didn't like when I tried to jump in because I would mess it up. So when I would walk up and I would want to play, and I would only walk up if I was with Heather. Remember Heather and Maurice were like, they were our best friends. They never saw our color. We didn't see their color. And as far as I was concerned, there was no color. So I would only walk up to these girls if Heather was by my side, and they would only hand me the ropes. I was only allowed to, you know, be the spinner of the ropes. This white girl is not jumping in right now because she's terrible. So I would, you know, play jump ropes with them. And that was the only time they would just say, no, it's because I would say, is it my turn? And they were like, no. They'd always go, no, no, it's not your turn. So I'm like, okay, I'll just keep spinning the ropes. I'll just be the jump rope spinner, whatever that was called.
But that dismissiveness took a harsher turn.
And there's one time that I remember that I was going out to the car to get something out of the car. And across the street is a lot of the neighborhood girls, and they start singing this song to me. Black is beautiful, white is funky. If you don't believe me, ask a white honky. And they said it really loud. And I thought, oh my gosh, some of those are my friends that I play, you know, jump rope with. And they're like pretty much harassing me right now. So I jumped in the car and I hid. I ducked down. I didn't even want to run back in the house. I just got in the car and just ducked. And I wanted to look again to see who is in that crowd, who is singing this, you know, obviously racist song to me. And I didn't even know what a honky was. Nobody had ever called me that before.
But one confrontation in particular pretty much ended any chance of playing outside again.
I just remember being really traumatized too after that time that you were held by knife point.
Welcome back. So the confrontations began to escalate in our Carson neighborhood, but one encounter in particular pretty much ended any chance of playing outside again. I think I was turning about 11, so I invited my elementary school friends over for a sleepover birthday party. Everyone wanted to go to the arcade, which was huge at the time, so my mom dropped us off down the street at the Carson Mall. We dropped a bunch of quarters on Pac-Man, Asteroids, and Space Invaders, I'm sure, then went outside to wait for my mom to pick us up. But as we were waiting, an older black teenager must have seen us as easy prey and pulled a knife on me, demanding we give him money.
I just remember being really traumatized too after that time that you were held by knife point. Because I remember I was with mom when we came to pick you guys up. I was in the car and we were going to pick you guys up in the front of the mall, but you guys were waiting in the back. So there was a miscommunication. And, you know, without cell phones back then, we're sitting there waiting for you guys and you guys weren't coming out. And then I remember us going around the corner, and I remember coming around the corner and the looks on your faces was just complete fear. And, you know, just after that, it was just terrifying. Then you weren't allowed to go to the mall anymore.
From then on, playing outside was pretty much off limits.
I don't have a lot of memories of playing outside. You know, we really weren't allowed unless, you know, mom, you know, maybe sat outside with us. But I don't remember really even being allowed to play outside very much. We would go to Heather's house or she would come to the house. But I remember the time we, I got a bike and I was so excited to ride it. And mom was always like, stay right in front of the house. Well, how are you going to ride your bike like right in front of the house? But remember, she would let us ride to the park if I was to go with you. But I remember one time my friend Shannon had spent the night and we begged for her to ride your bike. And I rode my Pink Panther bike and we were just riding around the front in circles in the street. And we put the bikes down on the grass and ran in the house to get a drink of water and come back out. And the bikes were already gone. So that definitely made mom say, okay, you guys can't even, you know, I don't even think we got another bike after that. But we weren't even really allowed to ride bikes or play outside.
We were now confined to the house. But things were getting so bad that even making our way from the front door to our car created opportunities for confrontation.
So I remember the time when we were outside with the car one time, and the guy, I think he might have been either a friend of the guy from across the street or what have you, but
who was very good neighbors.
Yeah.
But it was the boy, the friend that was playing basketball with him, mm-hmm. that started making the white comments and the honky comments and mm-hmm. finally came over and spit on our car,
yeah,
if you remember.
Of course.
Yeah. I was shaking. But yeah, whatever he did, and then he came over and I rolled the window up and he spit on the window.
I'll never forget that. We couldn't get out of the car until he was out of sight. The attacks shifted from verbal to a bit more aggressive.
Then, you know, then the people got bolder as far as like, you know, we'd have wine bottles thrown on the porch, on the front lawn, and beer cans, and people would yell stuff as they were driving by, laugh and yell. And then I went out one time, we had two cars with locks on the gas caps. They were glued shut. We had to have somebody come out and pry the gas caps off.
It became open season. No longer able to get us in the street, they started to break down the boundary of our home. That's when the break-ins started up again, in full force. It'd been years since someone had broken into the house. But then we came home one day and our front door was open. We'd been robbed. Then the next month we came home again. The front door was open. Robbed.
How many times did that happen? I felt like it was like a monthly thing there for a while.
It was happening so often, it became hard to keep track. One ransacking of the house just blended into the next. If I had to guess, I'd say it was about 12 or 15 times over the course of the next year and a half.
Coming home and your house is torn apart, your bedroom, like all of our clothes were just, you know, torn out of the drawers. Remember our mattresses were flipped over. You know, I remember having like my little twin star, little pencils and stuff. They were just everywhere, and some of them were broken. They were stepped on. I mean, our house was so ransacked. And then I remember one time they kicked the dog.
They had come in and they had kicked the dog, and you know, the dog was cowering in a corner.
And Benji was just laying there, couldn't move, and was just whining and crying. And you and I were just so worried about him. At that time, we didn't even go to our room and look around the house. We were just like, the poor dog was obviously kicked or something, because he's just sitting there whining. That was just so dramatic for us because it's such a violation.
It's like you lived in a glass house. That's after a while, that's what it was like.
It was obvious we were being targeted because we didn't see the police rolling up to any of the neighbors' houses, just ours, the only non-blacks in town. After a few times, the invaders weren't even taking anything anymore. It was just a complete annihilation of the interior.
There was nothing to take, and they had, because it was a monthly thing and they saw that, why did they continue coming back? What is the point? If you're not finding anything, what is the point? It's harassing. Maybe they wanted us out of there. I don't know.
After a while, with the number of break-ins racking up and no one getting arrested, reporting the robbery to the police became a big waste of time.
I mean, there was times where, honest to God, I didn't even call. We just cleaned it up.
I think me and you just left our room. We just left it ransacked. We stopped cleaning it up.
Yeah, because I remember one time the cops came by and said, oh, did they do this to your room? I'm like, no, that's how the rooms always looked. We just gave up.
We're done. Yeah. Here, we'll do it for you.
Yeah.
our drawers are empty, okay?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we're all exposed.
How does that saying go? If you don't laugh, you'll cry. I asked my mom for the first time recently why we didn't move out.
Rudy did not want to move.
Why?
He just didn't want to go through the trouble of doing it all. Even with the robberies, it just didn't. That kind of stuff just did not faze him. It was just something that happened, and you know, things like that didn't bother him.
Something was obviously brewing within my father. Something abnormal. His sister would later tell me that he returned from the Vietnam War a different man. The experience somehow scarred him. That may have been part of the issue, but not all of it. As a father today, I see that it's the man's job to keep the family safe. And Dad was failing miserably in that regard.
He didn't like change. He was not going to move. I could move if I wanted to. But he was going to stay there in that house until, you know, everything blew up.
And everything was about to blow up, even further. With Honky becoming our de facto nickname, it wasn't hard to tell that we were being targeted because we were white. Thankfully, all of the break-ins occurred during the weekdays when we weren't home, but it was only a matter of time before our luck ran out. It was December 1982, just a few days away from Christmas, and I woke up at that regular time in the morning. But to my surprise, Mom wasn't there. That never happened. I mean, never. Ever. She went to visit Aunt Marianne, was the explanation I got from my dad. Even as a preteen, I knew something was off. My dad followed our same weekday ritual. He dropped my sister, my little brother, and I off at our babysitter's. That morning, my sister and I walked down to a local park which was across the street from our school.
You asked, where do you think Mom was, or something?
And Denise knew. While Dad was out celebrating his birthday, a man broke into the house while we were there.
And I just remember waking up to hearing Mom like just scream really fast and just like a, you know, and like she got scared. So I don't sit up or anything. I just open my eyes and then I see Mom get dragged to her room by a guy.
I surrender.
Next time on Red Pilled America.
When you look at me and you see this Caucasian woman, like a minority looked at me and said she would never know what I've had to go through. But I know what that feels like to be the minority.
Red Pilled America is an iHeartRadio original podcast. It's produced by Patrick Carelci and me, Adriana Cortez, for Inform Ventures. Thanks for listening.